Hello, it's Wayne Perry, the TV carpenter here. Can I ask you a question? Are you a DIY doer? Meaning, do you like DIY? Do you like fixing things in your home? Or does it frighten you and you'd rather somebody else did it, like your other half, or you paid somebody to come and do it? The reason I'm asking the question is, it's either one or the other. People don't realise anyone can be a DIY doer. And for me, when I say that, I don't mean the big jobs. I don't mean putting up shelves. I don't mean laying laminate flooring. For me, DIY is about having a safe house for you and your family. So when I say safe, knowing how the smoke alarm works and why does it beep, or knowing how to turn your water off if your house is flooding, or if the fuse trips and your electrics go out, knowing what all the buttons on the fuse board do. So that's a safe home. I think everyone should have that. Everyone should have a practical home, meaning everything should work as it should. So if your curtain tracks falls out the wall, you know how to put it on. Or if your toilet seat breaks, you know how to change it. But also, I think everyone should have a beautiful home, knowing what paint types to use, knowing how to upcycle some furniture. If you would like a safe, practical and beautiful home, let me teach you the DIY around it. All you need to do is join the DIY Doers Facebook group. You can find it on Facebook, or you can go to my website, thetvcarpenter.com, and I'll link you straight through to there. Let me help you create a safe, beautiful, and practical home for you and your family. On today's show, I chat with Jonathan Adler. He's an American potter, creator of the most beautiful homewares, and he's an interior designer.
House or a space should really be a portrait of the inhabitant, but I see my job as taking a picture of the inhabitant as I see them, as they see themselves, and trying to reflect them in their most positive light. Like, I see myself as being sort of like a slimming mirror for my clients. You know, that one mirror you might have in your house that you just look a little bit thinner than you do in every other mirror, or perhaps a scale where you're like a few pounds lighter. I kind of think that's what I strive to be as a decorator.
Hello and welcome to the TV Carpenter podcast with me, Wayne Perry. This is a podcast where I interview everyone from the world of interior design and garden makeover shows, all with the aim of encouraging you to create your dream home. A huge thank you to Thorndown Paints for sponsoring this podcast. I had a quick chat with Caroline, the co-owner of Thorndown Paints, to ask her why she created Thorndown in the first place.
There was very much a hole in the market for what we wanted to do. And that was basically to produce a technically excellent paint with a brilliant and very extensive colour palette. So a paint that was just all about quality and simplicity. So that's how we came about with our wood paint. And it's very, very simple. Basically, it's a wood paint that you can use on any wood anywhere.
And if you'd like to try Thorndown's eco paint, don't forget you can go to thorndown.co.uk, and if you type in the code TV Carpenter, you'll get a 15% discount on any of their online purchases. Here we are, the end of season four. What a season it's been. Actually, what a year it's been. So over this time of me creating the TV Carpenter podcast, it's just been just over a year, we've had some pretty impressive guests. We've had just a lot of my friends from the world of interior design and garden makeover shows, but also some new friends and people I've been introduced to along the way. And my next guest is somebody who, when I first started the podcast, I wrote down a list of people who I thought would be really interesting and would be fun, and wouldn't it be great to get on the podcast? And ironically, it was quite funny that a year to the day of me starting the podcast was when I recorded this interview with none other than Mr. Jonathan Adler. So Jonathan Adler, he's a brilliant potter. He makes beautiful homewares and he's an interior designer. And I got to chat with him over lockdown. We had a Zoom conversation while he was relaxing in his Shelter Island waterside villa. And what was really lovely in the interview, I was at my parents' house, and his other half, Simon Doonan, popped on and we chatted about him and his work, and also their little dog, Foxy Lady, jumped into the screen as well, which meant my dog had to make an entrance. So as you're listening to this, there'll be moments where you hear Simon pop in, and also we have some oohing and aahing over our dogs having conversations together. But anyway, I hope you enjoy. This is the main event for my final episode of season 4. This is Jonathan Adler.
Thank you for coming on the TV Carpenter podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
First question is, whilst lockdown's been on, my wife has suddenly become obsessed with paddleboarding, and she's trying to find somewhere to do it. We've never done it. Please tell me that in this lockdown, in your beautiful summer beach house, you've had time to paddleboard.
Bro. I live on my paddleboard. It's basically all I do.
Yeah.
Up where I can talk on the phone while paddleboarding. So I probably should have been on my paddleboard right now talking to you. But anyway, I spend like at least an hour or two a day out there, and it's actually where I get my best ideas.
Really? Fab.
Yeah.
And does your other half, Simon, does he paddleboard as well?
He does. He paddleboards as well. I'm significantly younger and better than he is. So, of course, I outpace him. But yes, we are like, we both live on our paddleboards. It's funny. I don't know if this will translate to an English audience, but in America, like, tampon commercials show people biking and hiking and swimming and paddleboarding, and that our life is like a tampon commercial.
Love that. Absolutely. Yeah. We've got a dog just like yours. We've got a little Maltese Terrier. Does the dog get on there as well? Have you managed to get a little outfit for the dog to sit on the end of the board?
Foxy's not that into it, which is very sad because our last dog, Liberace, RIP, Liberace loved to jump on the paddleboard, and it was very media friendly. You know, it raised our wattage with the media significantly, because you can get a picture of a dog on a paddleboard. It's platinum.
Yes.
You
should start making outfits.
Yeah, exactly. For them
and design some paddle boards. I don't know if you've done that yet.
No, I would love to. It's funny. Both of our dogs have been huge disappointments, because Liberace, our last dog, hated outfits. He was a Norwich Terrier, and he was a very rough and tumble, rugged little fellow, and he could never handle wearing anything. Wow. And Foxy Lady is very beautiful and feminine, but dressing her up feels like gilding the lily. So she doesn't really like to wear outfits.
You don't need to do that. Just anyone who works in interior design, anyone who's a potter knows you and your work, and you know, it's beautiful. Was that the career that you planned? Did you plan to be where you are now?
It's such a funny question, because here I find myself 25 or 6 years after starting, and I can't even remember the actual truth, because I've told my story so many times over 25 years that the narrative has sort of dug a groove. But if I really think about what I planned, I don't know what the hell I planned, or if I ever planned anything. I certainly never thought that making a career as a potter was a viable option. You know, I went to sort of a posh university here in America, and you know, I wouldn't, in America, we obviously don't have the same class system you guys have, but you know, solidly middle, upper middle class family, that, you know, I just sort of anticipated a life in which I would have some cash and whatever. And I thought, being a potter, there was no chance in hell that could ever happen, because it can't. It's a preposterous idea. So it really, what really happened was, I had tried to make a career in the movie business after college. I worked like for a talent agent and for a literary agent and for a movie producer. And I truly got fired from job after job for just sheer incompetence and a bad attitude. And I was just, the true story of what happened was that my grandmother gave me like a little bit of cash. It was like, I don't know, maybe $10,000 or something. It was enough to sort of get me sort of not work for a few months. Mm-hmm. And I moved into a new apartment, and I had studied pottery in college, but I always struggled to really finish a pot. And I think that this is probably an interesting story and perhaps lesson for people who are in creative fields, because often there's, when you're trying to make something, there's a little bit of a difference between how something will look in your mind and how it comes out. And people often kind of stop doing what they're doing because they can't quite get it to the level they imagine it being. And that was a constant struggle of mine when I was in school. Mm-hmm. And so I had a little bit of money. I was unemployed and I was moving into a new apartment in New York City. And I said, you know, I always struggle to finish a pot. I'm just going to get a studio in exchange. I got studio space in exchange for teaching night classes at a pottery studio. I'm just going to get a studio. And the one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to take a few months and just make pots, finish them, and make stuff for my new apartment. Mm-hmm. And now here I am, unemployed 27 years later.
That's the best unemployed story, though. Selfie.
Yeah.
Nothing like being self-employed. Well, it's just doing your own
thing. I guess. It took me, it's so funny. I kind of did that for a couple years, and I continued to teach night classes. And it was only a year or two later that I was at a party with, and my mother was there, and someone said to me, "What do you do?" And I said what I'd grown accustomed to saying. I said, "Oh, I'm unemployed." And she said, "No, you're not. You're a potter." And I thought, "Oh, I'm a potter."
Yeah.
So yeah,
giving yourself that label as a potter.
Yeah, yeah. No longer considering myself unemployed. And at that time, I was still a Harry Potter. And now I'm, you know, old and just barely trying to hold on to the few hairs I have left on my head.
I can see you here. You're looking great, mate. Don't worry.
Oh, thank you.
So when you call yourself a potter then at that point, but to go from that to where you are now, did you get, you got a big order at one point? Does that set you on the road? Was it with Pottery Barn or something like that?
Yes. I mean, there throughout my career, there have been many little significant moments. You know, I can't really point to this happened and then, you know, kapow. It's not like one of those internet ads where all of a sudden the numbers start rolling over and over and over and that's the moment. But for me, it was baby steps. Like I continued to be unemployed and continued to make pots. And finally my parents said, "Well, you know, you're out of money now, so gotta sell a pot." And I sold a pot, and then I kind of sold a few more pots and got an order from Barney's, the now defunct but mm-hmm. legendary department store. And then I got an order from Pottery Barn, and that was a significant turning point, but one of many. I think this is, again, if for people who are interested in how careers happen, I think it's so easy often to sum things up into a tidy narrative in which something happens and that changes everything. But I don't think that's typically very realistic. I think it's normally baby steps.
I was chatting with Michelle Gundahin a couple of weeks ago. And she was saying,
love her.
Oh, she's the head judge on the show. I'm seeing her tomorrow, actually. We're filming tomorrow.
Oh, and send her my amour.
Oh, I will. And she's so lovely. And she was just so honest and just said, you know, she was always told in your lifetime you should have three careers. Do you know what I mean? So you go from editor to what she's doing, she's presenting. I used to be an actor. I'm now, you know, carpenter. And I think the life journey that you go along, that's the success. That's what, you know, that we should tell our younger people now, I think.
Yeah, I think we should just tell our younger people not to have overly high expectations. Like, just to, you know, Andy Warhol said success is having a job in New York City. And I think that the ideas of what success is have gotten completely deranged in the internet era and an era in which, you know, being an influencer seems attainable and money rolling in, but it's just a completely unrealistic lottery win. I think that people should just consider success keeping a job. However, you know, whether you change it or not, I think that's a luxury. Yeah. You know, I think it's the lucky few who get to have many successful incarnations, but the true success is just keeping a job,
yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah, I like half my thing now. Does it make me happy? Am I enjoying myself? Am I enjoying it? I think that's, you know, true success for me. As long as I've got enough money around me, you know, and then my family are healthy and well and we're happy, then we're winning.
Yeah. Well, obviously now during the coronavirus insanity, one of course remembers how important health is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But on the subject of many careers, I have a very annoyingly brilliant husband, Simon Doonan, who's a Brit. He's been my husband / tormentor for 25 years. Uh-huh. And he is infuriatingly successful, productive, and talented. And he, when I met him, he was sort of a celebrity in America because he was the legendary window dresser at Barney's, where I was already selling my pots. And we met in a blind date. Of course, we knew who each other were, but he was this kind of legend in New York. And visually brilliant and creative and blah, blah, blah. Then when he was 50, he wrote a book about his windows and he turned out to be a brilliant writer out of the blue. And now he's made a career. He's publishing like his 8th book. Amazing. They're all genius. I hate him. He is such a witty, brilliant writer. And his book, Beautiful People, which was a memoir of his bleak English post-war childhood, growing up gay in a family filled with lunatics, but sort of a comic memoir, was made into a BBC series like 10 years ago. And people should read Beautiful People by Simon Doonan and realize that my much better half and my tormentor is actually my much better half.
Well, talking about him then, together, you've done up your New York apartment. And if anyone looks on your Instagram, you can see it. And it is stunning. When I work with interior designers, normally the interior designer is the one with the creative force and then the other half kind of just nods and says yes. But the fact that both of you are so creative, how has that been when you're designing something together? Do you see eye to eye or are you, or does he let you have free rein or do you, is it shared 50-50?
Well, it's so funny. I think when people imagine gay couples, they think that there's a lot of sort of handbags, you know, fights and about things like interior design and where the obelisks are placed on the mantelpiece. Mm-hmm. And we, as much as we, one would imagine we conform to that stereotype, we really don't. We've never had one single fight or bicker over interior design. He kind of just lets me get on with it because he understands the creative process, having been through it himself, and says, you know what, this is sort of your canvas, go for it. Of course, I ask him his opinion from time to time, but he's very chill and kind of just lets me get on with that side of things. Uh-huh. And there's no sort of, there's no bickering about where the obelisks are placed on the mantelpiece, Shay knew. Yeah. It's a very harmonious sitch.
Yeah, but you even did his office. Normally, like you know, my wife has a dressing room and I've got my workshop. Do you know what I mean? We have an area that we can, you know. Do, you know, was he heavily involved in that, or did you do that for him?
I kind of did it for him, and he just obeys. As he said, he's, you know, I have a friend who is married to a legendary hairdresser, and she lets him do her hair. And he knows best. And I think Simon sort of says, you know, if you're lucky enough to live with your hairdresser, you would just let them get on with it. And so I think, as I said, there's no real like ego or bickering or opinions. He lets me get on with that. And yeah.
Yeah. Just talking about inspiration, like you say, you know, when you're on the paddleboard, you get inspiration. But I'm interested to know that, you know, right in the beginning, you made everything, you know, and now, you know, it's a big company and you have, you know, the Fantasy Factory, which is your workshop in New York where everyone's together. What's the time frame from you having an idea in your head on your paddleboard to actually seeing something that can be sold in a shop?
That's a really great question. And it's a complex and ever evolving scenario. And yes, when I first started and I made everything, the time frame was immediate. I could have an idea, jump on the wheel, and realize my idea. And now things are much more complicated. So if I, like a couple of years ago, I was on my paddleboard and I was looking at this beautiful sky, and there was just this perfect, perfect fluffy cloud on the horizon that was just the dream of what a cloud could be. And I was staring at it and thinking, oh, I wish I could just like jump into that. And I thought, oh my God, I need to make a sofa that's shaped like a cloud. Mm-hmm. So I sort of had the idea. And then the journey from that idea of a cloud-shaped sofa to the reality was over a year, because I had to sort of design it, find the right workshop to make it. I have a range of different resources at this point all around the world. So I need to kind of think about, you know, where that's going to be done. And then, of course, I have to see the first sample. It's always a disaster, the first sample. Yeah. It's never what you want it to be. You fall into a pit of despair. And then thinking like, oh, what a stupid idea. The world didn't need a cloud-shaped sofa. So you sort of stew over that for a few days. And then you think, all right, the world does need a cloud-shaped sofa. And I need to roll up my sleeves, figure out why the first sample sucks. Uh-huh. But it's a multi-month process. And then, of course, once you finally get the design right, the price has to be right. And the logistics have to be right. So what appears to be a very simple process requires so many different steps and so much rigor to actually get a product to market. So yeah, for the cloud sofa, it was well over a year, but it was well worth it because the sofa is like a dream.
Yeah, it looks beautiful. When you're working with your team, you know, for example, you know, you're a potter, you know, that's what you do, and you've come up with this cloud sofa, you know, you're not an upholsterer. Do you have, you know, you've said before that you've got some super talented people in your office. So how is that relationship with them? So for example, you speak to your sofa guy who works in your office with you. Do you sit down together and you to and fro and let him run with it for a bit, and then it comes, or her run with it, and then comes back and you tweak it together? Do you trust that? Are you able to hand over? What I'm saying is, you know, when I work with an interior designer, they'll say, I want this wardrobe, but they don't know how to make it. I know how to make it because that's my expertise, but they've designed it, and together we collaborate and create something that actually works and looks beautiful. Are you able to give that control away a little bit when you're working with the furniture guys, for example?
Yeah. When I first started, I was a true control freak and made every single thing myself because I thought only I can make things perfectly. And over the years, I've discovered that I have two authentic talents in life. One is I'm talented at making a pot, and two is I am talented at delegating. So I delegate the hell out of everything. And I have a team at this point of like probably four or five designers with whom I've worked for years and years and years and years. I'm thrilled to say that I am loyal to my team and they to me. So at this point, we sort of just understand each other, and I can bounce from designer to designer. In fact, when I'm in a normal situation, I'm actually in the office, unlike now during lockdown, I can, you know, bounce around from designer to designer and weigh in on this, that, and the other. And it's a steady process of a dialogue. But yeah, for me, I mean, the important thing is, as I said, that I have a team to whom I'm loyal and who's loyal to me. And I think that's a really important thing, because the process of getting something from idea to reality is incredibly complicated, and so many steps can go wrong along the way, and things can sort of go in a different direction. And it's a challenging process, requires a lot of analysis, and there are a million details.
Yeah. And just having that shorthand with your team, that's the key, I think, isn't it? They get you and you get them.
Totes.
Yeah. You talked, I've heard you say that you get, when you create something around the pottery wheel, or you create something and you get a real high from it. You're like, there's a moment of, you know, when something is really good, you get a euphoric moment, but you said it's quite rare. Have you had that moment recently? That high moment of something?
That is such a great question. I don't take drugs at all, but I am an addict to the feel. I'm addicted to that feeling of a successful product. It really is a true high. And when it happens, it happens. And I'm trying to think, since I've been on lockdown, it's been a very strange experience of sort of things coming in from different workshops around the world and me unpacking them. Typically, I'm on the road a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, in normal times, I might be in China or India or North Carolina or Peru or wherever my stuff is being made. What have I loved recently? There have been a few things that have come through the door that I've thought, yes, this is it. It's a high. There's like a new dinnerware collection I'm doing. There's a new kind of ripple-shaped bowl that's just looks just so right. And it is an indescribable high.
Mm-hmm. I love that. When you you do interior design as well. So you've done some, you know, amazing hotels. When I interview interior designers, everyone has a different approach to how they work with their clients. What's your approach? When you've agreed to work on somebody's house or somebody's office, what's the first conversations like with that client?
It varies, but what I really like to do is I like to ask my client to kind of come up with a three-word description of either who they are, what they want their space to be. Like in terms of branding, I hate that word and I hate the idea of a brand, but it's an important concept these days. I always think that a brand should be definable in three words. So my company is Modern American Glamour. And I think if one can achieve that to describe what you want your house to look like, it really gives me a starting point. So, you know, if you want it to be rustic, comfy, light, that might help me. Or even if it's three words to describe yourself. Mm-hmm. And then I can't remember who said it, but I think a house or a space should really be a portrait of the inhabitant. But I see my job as taking a picture of the inhabitant as I see them, as they see themselves, and trying to reflect them in their most positive light. Like I see myself as being sort of like a slimming mirror for my clients. Mm-hmm. You know, that one mirror you might have in your house that you just look a little bit thinner than you do in every other mirror. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps a scale where you're like a few pounds lighter. I kind of think that's what I strive to be as a decorator. Uh-huh. Or designer. I guess decorator in England means painter, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I say decorator. So that's kind of what I strive to be. And then, that's the sort of more conceptual side of things. In terms of the real nitty gritty, I think the best tool that has come around in millennia since the wheel is Pinterest. Mm-hmm. Pinterest has truly become the lingua franca of the design world. So I ask a client to just start a pin board and start pinning away. And they, you know, it can be anything from a detail to a room they like. And it's my job to sort of interpret it. And of course, being a decorator is a really, it sounds so simple, but it's sort of 20 million jobs in one. It's like being a psychiatrist, a clairvoyant, a marriage counselor,
absolutely,
an accountant.
Yes.
You know, occasionally a gigolo. You got to do whatever it takes. But more than anything, it's really being a maid, and one has to, like, you know, all the inferior desecrators who seem very grand are ridiculous, because it's the opposite of grand. Like, you're the help, and you got to, you know, scrub the floor, do whatever it takes to make it look. Yeah. Good.
Do they, when they look on Pinterest, do they just pin a load of your furniture though? Because they know they're hiring Jonathan Adler.
If they're smart, in an ideal world, they would.
House.
never seems to work out that way, frustratingly. But they should.
Uh-huh. And do you then as well, because I know what I'm like. I'll, for example, I needed a stained glass above my door. So I learned how to do stained glass. I've done it and it's up there now and I don't have to do it again. But do you do that when you're working with your clients? You think, well, I need a sideboard over there. I haven't seen one yet, but I've got one in my eye, what it looked like. Do you use that as a muse to feed the shop and all the rest of it?
Absolutely. That is really the number one source of design inspiration is need. People always say to me, like, where do you get your inspiration? And it sounds like such a simple question. I understand why, if you're doing an interview, you would say that, because it seems like a great question, but it's actually a ridiculous question. because, of course, inspiration comes from everywhere and nowhere, and it's not easily summed up. As much as people want a tidy little answer, it's impossible to answer because it's inspiration comes from everything. It comes from need. It comes from daydreams. It comes from dreams. It comes from history. It comes from contemporary design. It's all a it's like a whole maelstrom of different sources. And my fantasy in life is to never be asked again, where do you get your inspiration? So if that's on your slate of questions, strike it from the slate immediately, or I will leap through this phone and like cut you.
I've never been cut before, but yeah, okay. we're nearly there, actually. But just one of the things I've heard you say is, you know, you learn everything you know from failure. So that's when the best things happen. So I want to know, what has been the biggest failure that you've learned from?
Bro, that is such a good question. There have been so many failures along the way. It's a struggle to figure out where to even begin to list them. Oh, here's my English husband.
Do you want some tea?
Yeah.
Another cup of tea, please.
By the way, I just want you guys to know this is the very, very first time that my English husband has ever actually offered me a cup of tea.
No.
I'm the one. I'm always servicing him with his tea. So don't get the wrong idea that he's in service to me. It's au contraire, mon frère. But it was well played by that crafty English husband of mine. So anyway, yeah, failure, too many to list, you know, from being fired from jobs to getting products in that didn't meet my expectations or my dreams to seeing things that I thought were brilliant that didn't sell. You know, failure breeds humility and kind of helps you hone in on what you really care about.
Yeah.
I reckon.
It gives you grit. I say to my daughter, you know, I mean, you manage her disappointment, gives you grit, and it makes you move forward.
Yeah, it's super gritty. And I think, oh, the cup of tea was brought, and it was he's like a real old school English waitress in his sort of service style.
Yeah, it wouldn't work on Downton
Smile. Yeah, it's not like a Downton Abbey, like, you know, it's more like, yeah, kind of 1950s post-war grumpy. But yeah, oh, that's good. Yeah, I think failure is gritty. And and if your listeners take anything away from this, I think it is that it's not really an easy road, nor is it ever a straightforward road to what appears to be success. And nothing is what it appears. Success isn't what it appears. The journey is not what it appears. It is all really full of challenges. And what, you know, if you feel like you're failing at something, you should always know that so is everybody else, no matter how they appear.
Yeah. And in lockdown then, have you learned anything about yourself or your business whilst being stuck on your shelter island?
I mean, yes, of course, but our lockdown has been funny. Of course, you know, there's obviously health is the most important thing. And then the second most important thing for me is trying to keep my employees employed and staying sane and safe. But lockdown's been kind of wild for me. It's sort of been a combination of tampon commercial and that movie Blue Lagoon, where you're sort of trapped in nature, and a little bit like the old cartoon strip Beavis and Butthead, where Simon and I are so juvenile and idiotic and very like feral, and obviously Groundhog Day.
So
it's lockdown has been really weird, but I'm extremely lucky to be in a beautiful place, to be surrounded by nature. I've seen so many incredible things. There was like a baby seal on the beach the other day. There's a bald eagle in the tree next door. There's ospreys hunting. So it's been a true like natural paradisical experience.
And I think, yeah, for people who have that opportunity to get out, and you know, we have it in England, you know, if you have my parents' 350-year-old farmhouse, and they've just got loads of land around them, and all my family live on the terrace. There's about four houses all connected, so they just bubble together.
Oh, wow. And it's so you're very, very posh.
No, not at all. No.
Oh, yes, yes.
I live in London now in a 2-bedroom flat, and they, you know, and they live up here. It's the first time I've seen them in eight months.
All right, so you're very, very partially born, is what I'm guessing.
Not at all.
Always deny.
My family are proper working class, but have done well for themselves.
Nice.
They have been very young and lived in a council house, and now.
Oh, wow. All right. And, so you're gritty.
Yeah, gritty. We've got true grit. My dad was orphaned at 14, and
oh my god, wow!
So yeah, got true grit with that. But this is my final question, and I ask it for all my interior design guests. Now, money's no objects. It's a clean slate. I want you to describe to me your dream room. What's in it, and what you're drinking while you're in there.
Money is no object. What is my dream room? Wow, is that a good question? Do you want an actual physical space?
Well, just so a descriptive space that's in your head. Ah, Foxy Lady.
Foxy Lady has made an appearance. I think a descriptive space in my head would be probably a sort of a giant. Oh, what a cutie.
This is Harper. This is my little boy, Harper.
Harper, hello. Hello, Harper. Oh, my English husband is ooing and aahing over Harper.
The Maltese Terrier, little Harper.
The Maltese. Harper looks very naughty.
Yeah.
I guess, all right, Simon's off on his paddleboard now that he's exhausted from getting me a cup of tea. About which I'll be hearing for like days. About, remember that time I got you a cup of tea, he'll say. My dream room would be, I think the architecture would be like a sort of classic Parisian houseman salon with incredible herringbone floors and a beautiful fireplace and molding. Mm-hmm. And it would be furnished in a completely airy, very unexpected and dreamy kind of way. It would involve my cloud sofas and just all the favorite things that I have designed over the years, mm-hmm. sort of thrown together in a very unchoreographed, floaty, ethereal way, including a bed in the living room and a perch for Foxy Lady. And probably the most important thing would be that I would set up some sort of a little, I don't want to say cage, but something where I could keep Simon behind it with a kettle and all the fixings for a cup of tea. And I could have him just in service, sort of seen but not heard, bringing me cups of tea and waiting on Foxy and me while Foxy and I just sort of while away the hours in romantic bliss.
Okay.
So that's my dream.
And you're drinking tea then, I take it?
I am drinking tea, yes. Simon and I are both, neither of us drinks, not because we've had any hedonistic backstory. He's had a hedonistic backstory. I never did, but I'm just a teetotal and I'm just kind of like a hardworking teetotaling guy who tries to make a hedonistic, fantastical, dreamy, louche products. But my actual life is anything but. But my dream room would most definitely include a little cage for Simon where he sits behind it, maybe doesn't say a word, makes me cups of tea, and Foxy and I just sort of stare into each other's eyes in romantic bliss.
I love that. That's what happens after being with somebody for 25 years. The dog gets the bed next to you.
Oh my god, of course. Yes.
Jonathan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on the TV Carpenter podcast.
Thank you so much. Such a treat. It was lovely chatting with you. Peace out. I'm gonna jump on my paddleboard.
How brilliant does that sound?
living in a tampon commercial, just going on his paddleboard now and about to, you know, paddle round Shelter Island. It was such a lovely conversation I had with Jonathan. But what I really enjoyed is just saying that, you know, life isn't as you planned it. It's not as you'd expect, and it takes a lot of hard work, and there's lots of things that get involved with creating a successful business, being a potter and a designer. But if you look on Jonathan Adler's social media, on his Instagram, there's some really good Instagram stories on there, and you really get a flavour of what he and Simon are really like. And that's why I was drawn to them, and that's why I really wanted to get them on the podcast. And I'm just really pleased that they said yes, and I got to have them as my season finale of the TV Carpenter podcast. So I hope you enjoyed listening to that as much as I enjoyed creating it and speaking to them. And it is the season finale, but I will be taking a couple of weeks break, as I always do between seasons, and I will be back. I've already got some cool people lined up. I've started recording already for the next season, so don't worry, I will be coming back. Don't forget, you can go to Thorndown and get that 15% discount. Go to thorndown.co.uk and type in the code TV Carpenter to get that 15% discount from any of their products. But I just want to say a huge thank you. Over the year, this podcast has evolved and grown, but ultimately, the podcast is for you. So if there is a guest that you want me to interview, if there's a topic that you want me to discuss or uncover, or if you have any questions for me, don't forget, contact me on my website, thetvcarpenter.com. And all that's left for me to say for the final time of season 4, thank you for listening to me, Wayne Perry, on the TV Carpenter podcast.